This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Wherever you are in the world on this planet right now, I can tell you that no matter what your religion is or the absence of a religion in your life, I think you're going to find this one interesting because I've always found my guest interesting. He's been a regular visitor to me on the radio and the radio programs that I've done in a number of formats. And he's done this program before, too, because Chris Benyu is a fellow who has been writing his thoughts and his feelings and the spirit of Benyu for how many years now, Chris?
Wow, you're going to make me feel really old.
From the beginning of the time that somebody gave you a check for something that you wrote.
Yeah, wow, that's 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I started when I was five.
Yeah, sure, yes. And so we're about the same age.
Yeah.
When you first were on one of the radio shows, I believe you were writing for the Catholic Sun, a weekly newspaper, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you were with them for how long?
Almost 17 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Books, how many?
I'm on my sixth, so I've written five total.
Now, I know the one best that I'm a part of.
Yes, you do.
Because that's always the standard that I have. Am I somewhere between the front cover and the back cover? Am I remembered in this book? And therefore, automatically, it's a bestseller.
Absolutely. The best book has got to be the one with your name somewhere on it.
You've got one coming out, right?
Right.
Okay, well, I wrote an introduction or the foreword for a book that I thought had an interesting premise, and that was the one before this one.
The Best of a Better View, which was a collection of some of the, I thought, more relative and relevant columns that I wrote at the Catholic Sun over 17 years, and we put them into a collection that I think is still timely, even though I wrote them at certain times, that to just about everything that is happening in your life. And the whole idea of The Better View was a better way of looking at everyday life as an opportunity to reach out to love and be loved.
And Chris Benyu, you were raised in a Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still a Catholic?
Absolutely, 100%.
Why?
I think it's summed up best by the words of St. Francis. Preach the gospel at all times. When necessary, use words. And it's, I think, one of the greatest examples of what being Catholic is all about. When you look at the Catholic Church, in spite of whatever criticisms there are, the good works and the directive to do good works, to reach out to others, is such a huge part of the Catholic Church. And in fact, I went back and I found a column that I'd written a couple of years back, and I actually had a wonderful quote in there, if I can quote myself, which was, "What separates Catholicism from many other religious and philosophical views is the belief that life is good and valuable no matter what, no matter what challenges or tough times may befall us, and no matter how dark the storms that come. It's a religion and belief system that values human life and all life as special and distinct and therefore worthy of consideration." And I found a study, which was wonderful, by Notre Dame back in 2014, that found that 42.8% of American Catholics view human nature as basically good, compared to 30.8% of non-Catholics in America. And I thought, wow, that's a considerable bump up for Catholics. But it makes sense, because just about everything that you read and you hear, you know, throughout time, I'm not talking about incidental exceptions, but Catholicism basically says, hey, people are good, human life is valuable, go out and serve it and serve others. And
yeah,
that's why I'm Catholic.
Except for those incidental exceptions that come up and are sometimes shocking. You're always welcome here only if we invite you, but you're always welcome when we invite you. And in this case, we invited you because I wanted to know what the answer was. Why? You are still Catholic, and it occurred to me to ask you because you are of an age where a lot of folks have dropped out. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks have said, nah, it's too much trouble, and you know what? I don't want to go to Mass every Sunday, and it just seems to me like all religions are pretty much the same. But some people have said, no, I'm fed up because of things like the story that I read in the New York Times. There was an article in the New York Times just about a week and a half ago. And it was about a part of church history I'd never heard about. So I'm going to bring up to you some of the sins of the church. And you can talk to me about why we should either ignore them, forgive them, or put them in context, or whatever it is that the Bennu factor is. In this case, the New York Times article was about a large number of convents and universities, including Georgetown, a major Catholic university, still around, still very important academically, but a number of convents outside of the academic world that bought and sold slaves during the time of slavery in the United States. And I thought, okay, wait a minute. Regardless of whether that was accepted practice in the South, if it's a convent in Mississippi, it's still a convent filled with nuns who are supposed to be devoted to the grandeur of human life, including the African Americans whose lives were brought over here and sold on the open market. So how do you justify that?
Well, there's no way to justify that, and one shouldn't really even try to, because I always say I'm not a Catholic apologist. No offense to Catholic apologists, but I'm a Catholic. I believe in the value of the faith, not necessarily in the history of the faith. There's been far more things done wrong in the Catholic Church than that.
Was in the New York Times last week,
right?
So that's why I'm asking.
Of course. But you know, I mean, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, right? It's not going to stop me from being an American or believing in my country and believing in what the founding fathers envisioned for this country. You know, they didn't necessarily live live the credo that they were even writing down in the Declaration of Independence necessarily, but the ideas are still good. Similarly, these Catholics obviously were not living according to a Catholic way of life, but it doesn't in any way, shape, or form make that Catholic vision less. So we all have to do that, and we all have to think about that. Nowadays, you can point to a lot of people in the Catholic Church who I don't think are necessarily living in line or consistent with Catholic values and ideas.
And we are going to be bringing them up. Because I want to talk about the sins of the church and how it is that we can put them in some kind of perspective so that we, I'm talking about Catholics like you and me, so that we can have a different kind of perspective. In that it's hurtful when we read these things, or we read stories and see documentaries about the laundries in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You know those stories.
Sure.
Once again, operated by various orders of nuns, and the terrible mistreatment that those young Irish girls, most of them there because they were pregnant.
Absolutely.
And the fact that bodies were found of the babies, let's assume they were stillborn, but the kinds of things that went on in the laundries, the mistreatment, the cruelties, that's the kind of thing that causes me to say, that how could that happen if I'm a faithful member of the flock?
Well, it's easy. It's power. You know, when you look at the faith, it's the problems with the faith, or the problems with Catholicism and people who have acted in the, quote, name of Catholicism, I don't think has to do with something endemically problematic with the faith. The faith doesn't say abuse small children or sexually abuse others. There's nothing in the faith directive that says that. It's the manipulation that happens when you get out of control with power. And that happens in a lot of different places. I mean, look at the public school system in America, right? We have 10% of children in public schools are in some way abused, right? That's a very high percentage. Why is that? Well, you've got a power situation, right? You've got a teacher who has power over students, and that can become perverted. You know, human nature leads to a perversion of power. And when you have a power structure, as the church has had a tremendous power structure, that can lead to the perversion of power. So if there's any way to fix that, you look at the power structure and you say, well, maybe the problem is the power structure and the way it works. So you have people like Sean Patrick O'Malley, who is the bishop of in Boston, who was brought in because that was ground zero in the United States for the number of these cases of abuse. It was out of control.
Well, it's Catholic town America.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they brought this incredibly humble guy from the Virgin Islands in, Sean Patrick O'Malley, and he's Irish, so you'll like him. And he said, we have to totally reevaluate the way we're looking at our position to our to the parishioners. They're not here for us. We're here for them. And he knelt as he was being installed and asked for forgiveness from the parishioners. He then sold the $20-30 million bishop's mansion.
Yes.
And moved into a little apartment. He takes public transportation everywhere he goes because he says the idea is we are not supposed to be more powerful than our parishioners.
Now, that sounds like Pope Francis, too.
Exactly.
Living humbly.
Exactly.
In an apartment in the Vatican. Yes, surrounded by hundreds of millions of dollars in art and architecture, but still,
right.
He said, no, I tell you what, take my suitcase and move it down the hall.
Yeah, and if you need an anecdotal reason why I'm still Catholic, you can point right to Pope Francis and say, if there was any doubt or any thinking in my head that, you know, maybe I didn't want to continue being Catholic, when Pope Francis was elected, my faith was reinvigorated.
Definitely. Why hasn't he been tougher on pedophiles?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know the necessarily systemic answer to that. I can hypothesize. You know, obviously there's a lot of politics in the church. He's on shaky ground as it is because of so many of the things that he's been saying. He doesn't necessarily have the support of a lot of the bishops and whatnot that he's kind of rubbing the wrong way. So, you know, you kind of have to pick your battles and take your time to do things.
But people don't expect a pope mm-hmm. to pick his battles. I mean, if you're talking about power,
right,
it doesn't get much more powerful than that throne, that seat in the Vatican. And I'm talking about for even Protestants. I can't tell you how many times a Protestant minister has said to me, well, the truth is that when the Archbishop of Canterbury dies, he's on the third page. When a pope gets a headache, he's on the front page.
Right, sure. We talked about this a little bit years ago on your show, actually, when I think it first started, though. And I think there's definitely a much more developed schism in the Catholic Church right now, not only thematically between two different schools of thought, but very physically. We have technically, you know, not technically, but we have two popes, right? We have a pope that resigned and still walks around in you know, the papal garb. And
with the blessings
yes.
of Francis.
Yes, absolutely. But it's very interesting that we have that situation, because it is kind of a physical embodiment of what I think is sort of a schism in the church, where you have a lot of people who disagree very vehemently with the ideas that Francis is putting out there, which are very much in line with the ideas I was talking about, living Catholic and, you know, living by example, loving others being the primary goal of Catholicism, not necessarily adhering to this, you know, strict rule and power structure that maybe some other Catholics would like us to return to.
Let's get back, though, to the most heinous of the sins of the church, and that is pedophilia. You were drawing a parallel between public school education and the Catholic teachers. But the gym teacher at PS 48 or Sam Adams High is not representing Jesus. And the priest in the parish church and the priest who's in the school and the priest who is saying Mass and wants altar boys to help, he is the embodiment of Jesus Christ.
Sure, and I get that. I would argue that every single one of us is supposed to be the embodiment of Jesus and representative of Jesus as a human being.
Gym teacher said, right? I didn't sign on for that.
But yeah, but at least visually, right, and positionally, a priest is supposed to represent Jesus, so he carries a higher, he's supposed to carry a higher standard, right? But, you know, you look at doctors, right? Doctors are supposed to carry this almost godlike status when it comes to respect for our health. Are there bad doctors? Absolutely. There's doctors that do atrocious things, and their licenses are removed, hopefully. They're found out. And it does harm the medical practice when those people are found. But I don't, you know, you don't say, let's stop going to doctors because there were these bad doctors. But we expect, and I don't think it is fair, we expect priests and we expect the Catholic Church to be perfect. And I think that's not only illogical, because it's impossible, but I think it might be dangerous too, because I think that may be part of the problem. When I was a kid and we'd go off to have a field trip with the parish priest, my mom just didn't say, oh, that's fine, just go off and hang out with the parish priest. No, she said, I'm going with you, or are there going to be five mothers going with you on this field trip? We want to know.
Because of the parish priest?
Not necessarily because of him, but it was not a member of our family. It was not a close friend. It was the parish priest. Oh, who knows?
I may be speaking from my position in a different era. But I will tell you that having gone to school, a Catholic high school and college, and living on campus in the same dormitory facilities and so on, not only do I not remember even an incident brought up, I didn't remember anyone ever talking about the concept of a priest having any physical contact mm-hmm. with a student, grade school, high school, college. I mean, it was one of those things that only afterwards when the tsunami of incidents became a part of news fare, did I say to myself, when in the world did this start? And everybody else was saying it at the same time. They were still saying, I never heard of anything like that when I was a kid.
Sure, I was blessed to have never heard of anything like that when I was a kid either, actually happening. But, you know, times have changed dramatically, obviously, and we are more cautious of sending our kids out. You know, I used to ride around on my bike when I was 6, 7 years old all over town. You know, if a parent lets a kid do that now, they're almost accused of neglect or abuse, right? So we really are in an age when we are a lot more careful, a lot more cautious, and we should be that way with our interactions with the church as well. I mean, we need to protect our children. We need to do everything we can to. Along those lines, though, Patrick O'Malley, as I was talking about, Sean Patrick O'Malley, they rewrote the rules for how to determine, how to gauge and help people who work with children to be safer with them, and to find out, to do better background checks and find out if there's been any background or history. And that system that they created is actually being used by public schools and by those outside of the church now. It's such a thorough system. So, you know, the church has made some incredible strides to rectify this in some pretty important ways.
Okay, but even though I didn't hear about it and you didn't hear about it, historically, having now researched the reality of history, it was going on even then.
Sure, yeah.
I'm absolutely talking about pedophilia.
Sure, yeah. And like you said, you never heard about it, I never heard about it. That may be the problem more than the fact that it was even going on, is that nobody was talking about it. Nobody was trying to ferret it out. I think probably when it comes to the Catholic Church and this and the whole crisis, I think a bigger problem than it happening was bishops trying to protect and cover up that it happened. Because had those, and it was a small number, you know, one, I think it's the John Jay College discovered maybe 1% of Catholic priests had been accused of this in a verifiable way. And
it's still hundreds.
It's still hundreds. Absolutely. Absolutely. But when you talk about a 1% error factor, it's not that high.
Did you stop, though, during the peak of this, when people were still surprised, when Boston exploded?
Mm-hmm.
Did you stop and say, I don't want any part of this. I've got to rethink this whole Catholic thing. And boy, those Episcopalians are beginning to look more attractive to me all the time.
Well, no, and it might be because I'm a little more cynical than the average person being a journalist. I've interviewed a lot of people in a lot of authoritarian positions. Working in Hollywood for years, you know, I grew up seeing celebrities and stars who supposedly were these incredibly beautiful people who were always trying to help others and do these great things. And then I got to Hollywood and I found not only were some of them completely full of crap, but some of them were just downright despicable people. And I said, you know, everything is not as it seems.
You just reminded me. You wrote for the National Enquirer.
I did. Don't tell anyone.
Okay. I think it may be too late, but just erase what you just wrote down. No, you have a very, very interesting background and a very interesting reason for changing your employment. You wrote for a couple of different tabloids.
More than a couple. I was I started my career as a reporter for the National Enquirer and then was very quickly steeped in some of the most important stories of the 20th century, the O.J. Simpson story of chasing Michael Jackson around on the molestation cases. I've been in Oprah Winfrey's bathroom, you know, so that's fame if you've been there. And then I went from there to I worked for the National Examiner, I worked for the Globe, and I worked for People magazine as well. And so, yeah, it was, you know, I was up to my scruples in the glitz and grime and greed of Hollywood, as I always used to say.
And then what happened? Tell everybody.
Well, it's funny because my conscience got to me in it, and it really was my Catholic conscience, probably, more than anything.
But that was when you were covering a story.
I was. I was working on the Columbine story, and I was interviewing one of the parents of one of the victims and, you know, just trying to milk her for a great response. And, you know, one of the things you do in journalism is you try to get somebody as emotionally upset as possible, and then you get the real juice that you want out of that article. And she just started bawling when she was talking to me, and I just felt so bad suddenly. And she said, "Why do the journalists hate us so much?" And I just kind of broke down at that point, and I said, "Well, they don't hate you; they're just trying to use you for a story." And I am too, basically, right now. And you know what? You just need to hang up the phone, stop talking to me, stop talking to everybody else, unplug your phone, just go be with your family. You're doing the right thing. You know, say a prayer and just be with your family. That's all you need to do right now. And she stopped crying, and she just was, I think, shocked by the fact that I said that, as was I. And she said, "Thank you very much." And I hung up the phone, and I basically quit my job that day, and I just said, "I don't want to be a part of this anymore."
So you're a fallen away smut journalist.
I am, yeah.
Ever regret it?
The money was pretty good. It was, and it took a long time to be able to make money again on my own. But and every once in a while, when I go to a baseball or a football game and I'm not on the field, I'm a little bit taken aback. But other than that, no, I don't regret it at all.
Chris Benyu is our guest. Chris, you've just caught up with his entire background. And now he's writing books about a business.
So
that's a kind of an interesting departure.
It really was and is. And it happened sort of coincidentally. I was asked to help a couple of CEOs write their books. And I wound up meeting some of the most incredibly altruistic CEOs who were changing America and changing their communities by using their companies as a springboard to help others.
Wait a minute. No. American capitalist successful businessmen, I believe, have mostly been described as savage and cannibalistic.
Exactly. And I must be honest, I had that point of view as well before I met some of these individuals. And I was so taken aback by it, I thought they were anomalies. And then I started meeting more and more of them because I got into this community of altruistic CEOs. And I said, wow, wait a second. There's something going on here with these individuals who are really transforming their communities and society through the power of their companies. And they're not doing it just to make money, although, interestingly enough, their companies are profiting hand over fist because of this perspective and because they're doing business this way. But that's not the whole reason they're doing it. They're doing it because they actually like people. And when you meet these people and you talk to these people, you see that there's something going on in America that ties right back to what I was talking about before and why I'm Catholic and why I'm writing this book now and why I'm reaching out to these people is there's a schism in America and the world, I think, between those that believe that capitalism is a way to profit and hurt others and be greedy and those that believe that it's the greatest route to helping others.
Give me an example.
Tony Hsieh, wonderful example. I spent a couple of days with him up in Las Vegas, and he is the CEO of a company called Zappos, which sells shoes. And he started his company from literally nothing, and the company just blew up and was eventually bought by Amazon, but he still runs it. And he believes that he's not selling shoes, he's selling happiness. And you think it sounds like an incredibly crazy idea until you spend some time with him and you listen to some of the things that he's done. He had a woman who, a customer, quote unquote, who's never actually kept one pair of shoes that she's bought from them. She constantly returns her shoes. And she's an older woman in her 60s or 70s. And she buys shoes, returns them, buys another one, returns them, buys another one. I think back to my mom who used to do this over and over again. But when she kept returning these shoes, this email started going out across their company saying, hey, this is not right. We've got to stop this. We're not making any money off of this woman. Well, he has a system built in to his company where anytime there's a complaint that's going to cause a customer to be dealt with in a negative way, it goes immediately up to him. And he saw this email saying, we need to do something about this. And he stopped it immediately and said, no. You need to continue to sell as many shoes as this woman wants to buy and keep returning as many shoes to this woman as she wants to return because we are making her happy. And that's what we do. And incredibly, by, as he says, delivering happiness, his company is making incredible amounts of money and succeeding in such an extraordinary way. He's extended that delivering happiness to what he can do with the profits of his company. He's rebuilt downtown Las Vegas on his own dime because it was basically infested with drugs and infested with prostitution. And that part of Las Vegas had basically just been given up by the city. And so he said, you know what? I'm going to spend, I think he spent almost $750 million of his own money to do things like reinvigorate a record store there by investing in it and making it a recording studio where aspiring artists from the community there can come in and get a head start on their career. He bought a hotel that was a flea bag motel and was being used by drug addicts and prostitutes and said, hey, let's make this a place for young people who can't afford a nice place to come and get a leg up on the rest of their life if they're just starting their careers. He made a market out of what is essentially stuff that was getting thrown away, and it was a junkyard. And he said, let's take everything in this junkyard and build a really cool marketplace with all kinds of interesting art. Let's get the people from the community to come in and use all this junk to build art and make it a community gathering place. And then we'll put grocery stores in here, and we'll put a lot of other restaurants and gathering spots. He's completely reinvigorated the community in extraordinary ways. And when you go there, he doesn't want to talk about his shoes. He wants to talk about that. He wants to talk about his customers. He wants to talk about his employees. He lives in a trailer park that he bought, where he rents out spaces to other entrepreneurs who may want to do the same thing that he's doing. It's extraordinary. And when
remind everybody, though, who we're talking about, because they long ago stopped making notes. Because of the incredible things you're talking about, about one capitalist, successful entrepreneur. And I want people to remember what his name is.
Tony Hsieh from Zappos.
Now, you've met him.
I have. I met spent a couple of days with him. I liked this guy so much, I hugged him as I was leaving. And it was a genuine hug.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to meet him other than secondarily on 60 Minutes. And you just reminded me now, I hadn't thought about this story for a while. You just reminded me about something that has been planted back here that now I'm bringing to the front of my mind, because I said, wait a minute, that's the guy and that's the company that I remember being so impressed about, because on 60 Minutes, they did this wonderful story about the 60 Minutes reporter going by all these order takers in this massive headquarters area with all kinds of computers as the orders were coming in, right? And the reporter from 60 Minutes stopped for just a moment, and he looked over the employee's shoulder. And there was a Fred Astaire movie on the computer. So he thought, oh, I got this guy. Now, everybody else is working, right? And except this guy is watching movies. And then he heard the conversation, because the employee is on the phone with a woman, and he's saying, well, I think maybe I found the film where Fred Astaire is wearing the shoes you're describing to me.
Oh, that's incredible.
You remember Spectators? I don't know whether, I mean, it's a style of shoe.
Yeah.
Two colors.
Right.
And patterned. Right.
Right.
And she's trying to describe to this fellow, and he was wearing, and that's what I want. And he goes through all of the dance routines that Fred Astaire,
so he can find
in
it, yeah,
order to find the shoes, and he found them. And that's what boy, you talk about making somebody happy. But you see, now you're talking to a large group of people right now who are saying, all right, so there's one Zappo guy. There's one Zappo guy, and all the rest of them are crooks, because all they want to do is rip me off, and I can't get what I want when I order something. Or there's people that are scamming me on my computer, and that's what I associate with capitalism today.
And it's unfortunate that people do, but the problem is that people like Tony and so many others, I'm working on a book right now called CGO, Chief Good Officer, and how being good leads to being great. And I'm meeting and interviewing a lot of these people. The problem is that these stories don't get the kind of press that the negative ones do. And part of that is just that You know, it goes back to that age-old problem that I was talking about when I was talking about in the media. The media loves to tell bad stories. They love to talk about negative things. They, you know, they love to show, they love that age-old story of, you know, the man sticking it to the rest of us. But we're in an age now, I think, where we do have this schism in capitalism, where you do have a lot of those people that are doing it the wrong way. But you have a lot of these people that are doing it the right way. And the thing is, the people that are doing it the right way, like Tony, are making so much money doing it that way because people are responding to it.
But why aren't those stories being told? That's a marvelous, marvelous story. That's not just a feel-good story. It's something that should be on the front of the Wall Street Journal.
Absolutely. And honestly, I believe there is a bias, quite honestly, I think, in our journalism in America against capitalism to a slight degree. But beyond that, it goes to that compulsion with telling bad stories. They really don't have this interest or this love of digging deep, because you do have to dig a lot deeper when you're telling a good story than when you're telling a bad story. You know, it's like the old adage about comics, right? You get up there and you deliver a bunch of vulgarities, and you don't actually have to come up with anything ingenious. You just shock people. Well, bad stories shock people, so it's a lot easier. But when you're telling a good story, you've got to spend some time. I mean, I went there and spent time with Tony. I essentially lived in his trailer park with him for a couple of days and experienced what it was like to be there, you know, and experienced what it was like going out with him and seeing him. I mean, I spent 4 or 5 hours with him one night going to clubs and seeing the community people interact with him and how they loved him so much and why they loved him so much and how an average everyday person from downtown Las Vegas, a 20-year-old, could come up to Tony and just tell him about an idea she had, and he was open to it. I couldn't believe that.
What do you say? What do you say, though, to the people, and they are sadly in large numbers these days, to the people who say, well, if there's anybody who has a bias against capitalism, it's the Pope. The Pope, who seems to thrive on really pushing a socialist way of life.
You know, I would disagree with the fact that he's pushing a socialist way of life. What he's pushing is some concept of social justice, which I think is very different. He has never at any point said government needs to come in and control this. Quite the contrary. He's continually said how it is our responsibility in America to be a leader in this. Now, America's a capitalist country, a country of freedom. Over and over again, he said it's the responsibility of our economic leaders to stand up and do the kind of thing that Tony's doing. And if every leader in America, every CEO in America did this, it would change the face of America and the world. Now, the pressure is being put on them by these positive, altruistic CEOs. We see the proof of that right now in there's something called the Business Roundtable that some of your listeners may have heard of, some of them not. It's sort of an obscure group of very high-level CEOs who just recently signed a pledge that from now on, shareholder interest would not be the first and foremost concern of corporations, but actually the value to the community that that corporation was exhibiting. That's huge. And to be completely honest, some of the people in the Business Roundtable I'm not a big fan of because of some things they've done in the past, and I think they are responding to the popular pressure that's being put on now by some of these other CEOs who are doing it right and saying, you know what, if we don't start to do it right, there's going to be such a backlash against capitalism that our companies and our way of life are going to be completely destroyed. So I think that on the one hand, I don't agree with this, you know, painting capitalism in this negative picture. If it makes more CEOs and capitalists stand up and say, let's do it right, then, you know, that's great. That's fine by me. But we need to have the attention on those capitalists that are doing it right. And, you know, and for me, you could also you could almost call it Catholic capitalism because
well,
that's what
I asked
think
you at
doing.
The beginning of this program why you were still a Catholic. My next question should never be construed as a reflection on a party, an individual, any elected official, because I don't intend that. But I will tell you that with the lack of civility, with continuing and growing levels of violence, particularly in our urban communities, with the kinds of things that are going on right now at a greater intensity than we've seen in the past, at least in the past that we can identify in our lifetimes, why are you still an American?
I've talked about this so much. The freedom that we have here to do the right thing, the freedom that we have here to love our neighbor, the very thing that I'm talking about, and the challenge that we have in America to be good or evil, we have that right to be evil in America. And the fact that we have that means we have free will. That's at the essence of what it means for me to be Catholic, for me to be Christian. Without free will, you cannot choose to do the right thing. Without free will, you cannot be moral. Without free will, I would argue, you could never even be Catholic or Christian. It is the ability to do the wrong thing and the choice to do the right thing that makes you moral. And in unlike any other country in the world, we have that ability here in America. You can lead your life as a horrible person in America, and you can continue to live that way as long as you don't kill anybody, steal from them, or you know, break any of the major laws. Hopefully no one wants to live that way, but it's by contrast that we see the moral, that we see the valuable, that we see the people that are good. And guess what? The majority of people in America are good choose to live that way.
Chris, why are there still so many, after all of the wonders that you're talking about, that are uniquely in this country, why is it that we still have the proclivity among so many people to exercise that free will to hate our neighbor because of the color of their skin or because of where they worship?
I don't think the concept of hate is in any way, shape, form, or form uniquely American. When you travel abroad and when you know people who have traveled abroad, you know, you hear of ghastly stories of racism and the fact that we have free speech in this country and the fact that that free speech is so promoted makes us talk more about it and hear more about it. But you see this go on everywhere. Hatred is human. It's not American. And, you know, when you ask what the deeper reasons for hatred are, well, that's probably another show. But I don't think there's anything uniquely American about hatred. If there is any aspect of hatred that potentially could be connected to being American, I think you probably have to bring it all the way back to some sense of economic injustice, probably more than anything else. Because, you know, we have this old saying in journalism, we used to, you know, always say, follow the money, right? You want to understand what the reasons for a story are, you follow the money. Well, we do have a sense of economic injustice in America. I think we've probably got it's a time in America when you see a lot of inequity, a greater inequity than we've seen in a lot of time between the super rich and the super poor. The challenges that the middle class have and have had. I think a lot that is the origin of a lot of this anger, more than any kind of racism. But I think when you talk to people that were in some of the small towns in Pennsylvania, some of the people that, whether they were white or black or any other color, but they're in poverty and they're seeing all this wealth in Washington and they're seeing all this wealth in Hollywood, they're seeing all this wealth in Wall Street, and they're saying, you know, why don't I have a piece of that? Why am I struggling to such a degree? And it does breed some anger, and that anger can lead to hatred. And unfortunately, that can be used by others to manipulate in a lot of different directions. So I think all of this comes back to those CEOs that I'm talking about really being the hope for America if they can help to create an America where all are being served, where all are being acknowledged. I think it's going to go a long way to dissolving that hate. And I think they're the greatest hope for it.
What about the CEO of the Catholic Church? What does Pope Francis have to say about economic justice?
He's had a lot to say about economic justice. In fact, I think the book that he wrote on the environment, technically, was a lot more about economic justice than it was about the environment, because almost every time he talked about environmentalism, he linked it back to how not being environmental is causing abuses of the people in third world countries. And it is. You can talk all you want about environmentalism, and it can sound real great until what you realize you're talking about is not in my backyard thinking, which goes on a lot. No, I don't want the power. I don't want this power plant in America. No, I don't want this mine in America because it pollutes. But some of those same people will allow that mine to be in Africa or in some third world South American country where it's being mined with less regulations, less laws. The abuses of the employed are worse. And a lot of people don't seem to care about that. Some of the worst environmentalism is going on in third world countries and abusing so many of the people in that community that it's a form of economic abuse. It's keeping those people down. It's using cheap labor. And that is so much more important to look at the economic injustices that are happening in those third world countries are ghastly. And I think the Pope has tried to bring attention to that in a huge way, and we all need to think about that more.
I want to hear another story about some of the people that you interviewed for the new book. Some of the guys that are like the Zappo Shoemaker.
Well, they're not all guys. So some of them are women.
Good for you. good for you. Mine is a lowercase guy. Supposed to apply to everybody.
I do the same thing all the time. But Cheryl Backelder she used to be the CEO of Popeyes. Now, she's moved on, and she just took a new position now. Forgive me, because I'm not sure where she is right now. But she rebuilt Popeyes, and she took it from being a failing company to being an extraordinarily successful
company.
Remind
everybody you're not talking about the cartoon character.
No.
Very, very. But you don't have Popeyes everywhere.
Right, that's true. Popeyes chicken, which I guess they're not everywhere. I see them everywhere I seem to go. But
it's kind of Cajun hot chicken.
Yeah, they were in the Midwest and the South only for a while, and now I know they've spread out a lot. But that was part of her doing, too. She reinvigorated this company, and the way she did it, which was fascinating, was if you ever speak with Cheryl, she is a woman who reminds you of sort of a cross between your aunt and your grandmother, okay? You think she's going to come out and just, you know, make you dinner, but she is an incredibly astute professional who has run multiple companies, and she rebuilt Popeyes, but she had that attitude towards her franchisees, and in turn to the customers and her employees, of treating them as if she was their aunt or their grandmother, you know, bringing out dinner. And she said, "This is how we should run our company, as a community of people who care about others, and every Popeyes should be a community in itself, in its community. And it should have that approach to its customers. It should have that wholesome approach. That's what we started our company as." And it did. You know, Popeye started as kind of that wholesome chicken place, not a franchise, kind of a chicken place. And she said, where we went wrong is we tried to expand too quickly, and we forgot who our franchisees were. We forgot the communities that they were in. And she has this wonderful story that she told me about how she was talking to a franchisee at one point, and he was talking about the challenges and the economic challenges and you know, if they could renegotiate some ideas and thoughts about the contract and everything. And she said, "Well, last time we talked, you told me you were going to be getting married soon. Did you ever get married?" And he said, "Oh, well, you know, my wife, my new wife, you know, I blah, blah, blah. I met her and we came together. They were immigrants." And she told him this wonderful immigrant story. And she said, "That's beautiful. That's the kind of franchisees we want. We'll figure out whatever we need to work with you." And and that's the way she kind of built and rebuilt the company.
But she's in the thighs and wings business. I mean, when you're talking about somebody who's feeding people, it's wonderful when you hear that kind of a story. But then on the other side of capitalism is the banker. It's the guy that forecloses on Jimmy Stewart at Christmas time. And there's always that guy in the front office of the banking business. And yet you speak very well of Jamie Dimon.
Well, Jamie Dimon is a guy that's, you know, Chase has been, it's had its ups and downs, you know, as far as its experiences and doing things the wrong way. And I think Jamie has learned some incredible lessons from that and said, hey, you know, wait a second, we need to kind of turn things around and change things. And so, as I'd mentioned before, this business roundtable, which he is the chairman of, he has decided to really take a stake in trying to change the direction of how CEOs see their responsibility in America. And for many, many years, the age-old rule in companies was, if it's a public company, first and foremost, you satisfy the requirements of your shareholders. Your number one goal as a company is to increase the profits of your shareholders at all costs. As long as it was legal, your job was to increase the profits of your shareholders, make the stock go up. And for the first time, this is huge, he signed a pledge and he got dozens of others in this business roundtable of some of the leading CEOs in America to sign a pledge that says, wait a second, we're gonna kind of flip this coin, we're gonna flip the switch and say, it's no longer just something nice that we do on the side where we say, wouldn't it be great if we can have a presence in our communities that really helps the community and we can get some great PR for that. We're actually gonna make that first and foremost the goal of our company, to improve the communities that we are in and the community of our world.
And you call that a Catholic way of doing business.
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, like I said, I think when you look at this Catholic perspective of doing good works, and it is such an important part of our identity as Catholics, and in fact, not in any way, shape, or form to defame any other sect, but I've been called on the carpet by those that are non-Catholic, who actually accused me one time of being too concerned about doing good works. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, you can't get to heaven by just doing good works. I said, really? What else do I have to do? And but it is very much a difference between some certain Protestant sects and Catholicism. And I've had philosophical discussions with a lot of my Protestant friends about this. Because Catholics really do believe good works are first and foremost what it's about.
That's kind of one of the tenets of the church, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And just philosophically, a lot of Protestant sects say, no, first and foremost is accepting Jesus. And secondarily, it's what you do with your life. And I think Catholics are the other way around. I've had a lot of discussions with Catholic priests about non-Catholics who they affirm are leading Catholic lives. In fact, I wrote a column one time about a friend of mine who I said, he's one of the most Catholic people I know, and he's Buddhist. But he's living his life in an extraordinarily Catholic way.
Was he offended?
No. No, he thought it was actually kind of novel. But the idea of being Catholic is universal, right? It's what the word means. Catholic means universal. And the whole idea of that is really reaching out to everyone in the body, quote unquote, of Christ. And so I truly believe, and you can look at a lot of data that shows the effect of Catholics helping others across America, the amount of social good that Catholics do in Catholic organizations and just as Catholics working on their own is extraordinary. And I think it is part and parcel of getting this idea into CEOs and into the corporate culture. So I do think it's Catholic capitalism in a big way.
With only a minute left, reflect, if you will, on the whole purpose for us getting together again, and that is people who continue to be Catholic in spite of being faced with the sins of the Church. Are you a more faithful Catholic now than when you celebrated your first communion, when you were confirmed, and you were innocent?
100%. I don't even know that I knew what it meant to be Catholic when I, you know, got up there and said that I totally devote myself to being Catholic.
But you were innocent.
But I was innocent, exactly.
And you didn't work for the National Enquirer.
And I didn't. I had no idea that I one day would. But yes, it's given me a greater respect and understanding of what it means to be Catholic by going out there in the world and being faced with the challenge of, am I going to lead a good life or am I not going to lead a good life? And I think my Catholic faith and upbringing was the reason why I decided to lead a good life when the challenges came my way.
But if somebody out there right now, somewhere in the world, is struggling with his faith or with her faith, and it's because of the headline stories, it's because of TMZ slamming them in the face with something that a priest or a nun or another Catholic did, what do you have to say to those people?
I would say to call up St. Vincent de Paul or any other Catholic organization and volunteer to go help them. And within about 2 hours of you being there, you'll remember why you're Catholic.
Thank you. Chris Benyu. Oh, what's the name of the new book?
CGO, Chief Good Officer, and Why Being Good Leads to Being Great. And if any CEOs out there would love to contact me and talk to me, or anybody that works for one of these companies that has a CEO like this and would like to be considered for the book, please reach me at www.executivebookdevelopment.com. Again, it's www.executivebookdevelopment.com.
What if somebody just wants to get in touch with you to say, hey, I really liked what you were saying on the God Show?
They can reach me at that same address as well. And send me a message. I'd love to hear from them.
And you can reach me at thestarworldwidenetworks.com. I'm Pat McMahon.